Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. What does it take to create a truly equitable healthcare system? From entrepreneurs to investors to community workers from across the globe, this season we're speaking to the people aligning capital and technology to find the answer. This series is produced in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation as part of a series investigating the trends, challenges, and opportunities in the global healthcare sector. My guest today is Josh Nesbitt, CEO of Medic Mobile. Medic Mobile is a nonprofit organization founded to improve health in the hardest to reach areas on planet Earth. The organization builds open source software that helps more than 25,000 community health workers provide care for 15 million people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. In 2014, Medic Mobile received the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. Josh studied global health and bioethics at Stanford University, where his research focused on pediatric HIV/AIDS in Malawi. Josh was selected by DevEx as one of 40 under 40 leaders in international development and was named by Forbes as one of the world's top 30 social entrepreneurs. In 2016, he received the Muhammad Ali Humanitarian Award. Welcome, Josh.
Thanks so much, Paul. Great to be here.
So Josh, you were an undergraduate at Stanford University on track to go to medical school. What triggered your change in the direction towards entrepreneurship?
Well, first of all, I should probably explain my dispositions there. I come from a family with deep roots in healthcare and public health. And I sort of figured at the time that no matter what my understanding of good or my moral philosophy was, that caring for others would probably be okay. And so I sort of set off on the path to go to medical school. And I was heavily influenced by my mother, who is a physical therapist, and I spent 30 years looking after kids with specific needs. And also my sister, I was influenced by both of them to really have global as my default, if that makes sense. And I ended up in Malawi doing qualitative research, really listening to the caregivers of children with HIV and AIDS to understand why more kids weren't getting access to and staying in treatment. They were really sort of long listening sessions. And while I was there, I was essentially trying to be useful with any time that I had. And I was counting pills in the pharmacy and I was helping do paperwork. And I was able to spend time with the one doctor there. And that physician was in charge of healthcare for about 250,000 people. And those people were spread roughly 100 kilometers in every direction. And you had patients and their families walking or ox carting up to 100 kilometers to get to that hospital. And that system flat out, just it wasn't working for people. You know, it was designed by people over time, but it wasn't working for the people in it. It wasn't working for the patients or the family caregivers or the doctor themselves. You know, at 6 a.m. every morning, I'd wake up and I'd see a line full of people in the outpatient ward waiting to see that one physician. And in a way, I was on a path to be the second physician. And we need many great physicians. And my sister is one of them, a pediatrician in San Francisco. But it was just clear that the system was not designed to reach people. And more specifically, it was designed to exclude people who were poor and far away. And then I think there were some realizations. I met community health workers, and that led me to rethink who we view as health workers and what the implications of that might be. These community health workers were walking 30 kilometers with handwritten notes about how their patients were doing in their remote villages. They were knocking on the nurse's door and requesting and really demanding that they review how their patients were doing and give them feedback and guidance so they could go continue caring for their neighbors. And that showed me people fighting for a different kind of role in the system to be part of that care team and really sort of shining a light on who is providing care, where that care is happening, and really our lack of support for them. And those were, I think, the fundamental shifts, sort of spending time with those community health workers. And then the final one for me, this was 2007, 2008, was a realization that we had new infrastructure. We had new tools available to us. There were cell towers being put up everywhere. You know, there were even communities that were springing up around the cell connectivity. You know, things had sort of flipped around. And we, at that time, were not using the mobile infrastructure to support those health workers. And that seemed off to me. That seemed wrong. So, you know, the shift into entrepreneurship was really building something with those health workers and then trying it. And it was just a simple messaging platform that let the community health workers communicate with the hospital team. And then 6 months later, we looked back and saw how the hospital team was working differently, what the community health workers were doing, what village elders and leaders were saying. And we studied the effects. We looked at fuel logs. We looked at all the changes. And we saw the improvements in people's lives. And at that point, there was really no way to turn my back on them.
So great social entrepreneurs take what seem to be intractable problems and then try and solve faulty systems, generally through an innovation and often through an application of technology. So tell us about what Medic Mobile actually does and how you are seeking to bring a technological innovation and a system innovation to bear on what looks like a really deep problem.
What we're building with communities is a totally different type of healthcare system, and it's now a reality for millions of people. And how it looks is a community health worker who is responsible for care for about 100 families around them, going door to door and making sure everyone is in the healthcare system, first of all, but then returning regularly for proactive visits, ideally at least once a month per person, to just check in, see how people are doing, and care for people who have concerns or children who might be sick, for example. And as they're doing that, the care is provided at home, and it starts where people are, and they're pulling up a software application that guides them through the concerns that are presented and gives them a result screen that guides them through next steps. Often the family and the health worker are looking at that application together to decide what to do. And between 80 and 90% of the time, that care can stay and be provided at home and people recover. And so it's as preventive as possible, as proactive as possible. It's focused on speed, quality, and coverage and equity. So it's very unfamiliar to me as an American, but very much where we see healthcare headed.
And tell us how you think this, I can imagine a dozen different ways, but for our listeners, tell us how you think this offers a qualitatively better form of healthcare, not just to one that is absent, but is in fact better than the healthcare that is provided in institutions or in hospitals or in a more centralized way.
There are consistent delays that lead to unnecessary loss of life in our healthcare systems. And that's true everywhere. And it's especially true in the poorest parts of the poorest countries. And I saw that firsthand in Malawi, where people went to the hospital as late as possible because it was where you went for palliative care, essentially. It was sort of the last resort, and it was a whole family effort, and it took days of time away from the farm, and it was just really a really hard thing to do. So there's delay and hesitancy. People need great care at district hospitals, but it should be secondary and tertiary care, and we should have specialists there. But 80, 90% of what people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis, what mothers are concerned about, can be handled at home and can be sort of managed with support and care from a neighbor that you trust. So it's sort of really flipping it all over, right? Right now, you have to navigate a mess of systems that you don't know and don't trust and are unfamiliar. And what we're starting with is the trust between people, often 1 or 2 degrees away from someone's extended family, who have grown up with and known each other in some cases for decades. And we're starting with that trust and starting with where people are.
And I know you use a kind of human-centered design approach to ensure that Medic Mobile is as useful as possible to healthcare workers. Tell us about this philosophy. Tell us what that means in practice.
Sure. I think human-centered design can be a revolutionary thing if we let it. And what I mean by that is it's a set of methods and really a process that puts the needs and dreams of people first. And specifically, people who've been ignored and disempowered over and over again by other systems and other processes. So I think in its grandest form, that is what it can be. And I wish it weren't so rare to try to solve the problems of people that we all rely on as heroes, but it really is. And I think that's what we try to do at Medic. We put community health workers and community members at the center of the process, try to put them in the driver's seat with methods that feel really familiar to them. And the methods have all sorts of names, but I'll just describe them with sort of more common terms. The methods are spending time together. We call it professional hanging out. They're storytelling, you know, asking people to share their stories and reflecting on meaning and purpose with them. We have playing cards that tell the stories of a health system and what happens first, seventh, and tenth in that system, all the different events. And then we take the cards off the table and we play new cards together. And we place ourselves on the table in different character roles. So we play cards. And then we try things out. You know, we recognize that health workers are creative and they have opinions and they have ideas. So we try things out together. And often they tell us things that we just could not have seen ourselves.
And I know that the collection and storage of data is an essential part of Medic Mobile's approach. Why do you think accurate and up-to-date data is so important to improve health equity, and how do you actually use it in order to achieve this?
It's a really good question. I would say, you know, first of all, I think about the type of care system that I would want to serve my parents or my grandparents and my child. And, you know, if you think about that, what I would say is the next step is that everyone deserves that sort of system. And what I've learned over the years is that the health workers and community health workers, they want that kind of system too. And of course, that includes accurate and up-to-date data. And that's because health workers are called to care for others during these intense moments of uncertainty and grief and pain and concern. And for them, it's just really critical that they can rely on what's in front of them, and that when they provide guidance to someone, you know, their entire relationship is not on the line, but it's being leveraged in that moment, right? Because in this intense trust, so we have to build on and not betray that, and that requires good information and just good systems that relies on the info, and so. In order for community health to be this ground truthing initiative and to sort of realize its potential, we need real information. And that's, I think, a shared understanding with the health workers. It's why good information goes in, because they want good information out. And I think we're all recognizing together now that if we do that, then we have new visibility into the care and care work that's happening, but also into the speed and equity and coverage of these systems. Whereas previously, we have our 5-year reports or sort of snapshots at a national level about the inequities. And we see the same data and the same reports over and over again. What we're looking at now is sort of hyper-local inequities and also progress against them. And then those practices can spread.
So one of the great conundrums in social entrepreneurship is how you recognize and measure impact, how you chart your progress towards your social goals. You've adopted an impact measurement framework, which you've called distribution ethics. And can you explain to us what that is and also how it guides your work and your approach?
Yes, for sure. This took us some time to figure out. And what I would say is that this tool and framework is as much for founders and teams as it is for the day-to-day evaluation of the effects that you're having. What we stumbled across were different fellowships, different frameworks, and sort of things offered to us that in some were just ended up being highly technocratic. It was a technocratic approach to building a company or an organization. And what was missing in these sort of steps of sort of, you know, sizing up a market and like lean iteration on a product and building an organization that's designed to deliver more of that product. And anyway, this sort of step-by-step playbook, what was missing in that playbook was a moral stance. And what we learned over the first couple of years of our work was that we either needed to reflect on and articulate that moral stance and take it, or we were going to be handed it by others or positioned into it by others. Like our context was going to shape what our moral stance was. And I think we sort of built this framework out, realizing that whenever there's a distribution of an undeniably good or helpful thing, I would say healthcare is one of those things. And there's a question of who is harder to reach and why. As soon as it's established that some people are harder to reach than others, you have an ethical problem and you have tensions. And at that point, you have to draw on wisdom traditions. You have to draw on a lot of good thinking, or at least a lot of thinking. And we turn to different options like a utilitarian or egalitarian or libertarian framework. And we just talked through what distribution would look like with those frameworks applied. And, they're not the only answers. That exercise centers on a sort of consequentialist view rather than a virtue ethics or care ethics or feminist ethics. But the conversation itself, I find again and again, talking to founders can be really freeing and illuminating. And once you articulate that moral stance, of who deserves and will get that helpful thing in the end state so that it's a just system. When you articulate that, you find people who believe the same thing. And at that point, there's great partnerships. You can recruit great teammates. You can build the thing that you and communities dream about. And it ends up being a really useful exercise.
So can you give us a for example, because I find this fascinating, give us a sense of how your approach would guide strategy or resource allocation or staffing or a decision that you would make in order to enhance access to healthcare. What is it that this approach enables you to do or guides you to do that not having it would preclude you from doing?
Great question. So this operates at every level, honestly. And you sort of, if you name something about our organization, I'll tell you how distribution ethics relates to it. I'll give you a couple of examples. In terms of equity being part of an evaluation framework for the tools or for healthcare, most people are not pushed to include that. Most people don't talk about the distribution of care across wealth quintiles at a community level of 2,000 people or less. We're laser focused on that, and we're going to work with partners until we are achieving equitable outcomes for and with those communities. And it's what the communities want too. They're not going to want to stop at a certain level of inequity and move on. That it's sort of to say this is a just system. That requires long-term thinking, partners that believe the same thing, and funders that step up to support it, and governments that create an environment where you can work towards that with the communities and with our government partners. So that is a good example of like just looking again at what the actual operational unit is before you scale for a model of care, for example. Another good example is, which organizations get the software. How does the tool that you're building that enables the distribution of care, what does that distribution look like? And, we're building an open source platform. We believe these tools should be public goods and they should be core parts of public infrastructure that we simply could not embark on and sort of try to provide it as much access as possible. We just flat out could not do that if we didn't have partners that believed in those distribution ethics, not only for the healthcare, but for the thing that helps.
So at the top of the show, I recounted some of the remarkable impacts that you have had, the sheer breadth of your impact, the number of people served, the number of communities impacted. And this can only be done if you work with partners at a community level, at an organizational level, with government. So tell us how you work in collaboration with others in order to amplify the impact of your work.
Absolutely. I think the simplest description is that we build open source software and we rely on partners for the rest. And, you know, the implementation of the software itself, you know, the training of trainers and gathering of health workers to onboard them to the platform, the stocking of medicines for those health workers, the supervision and oversight for the care, the referral and referral networks to ensure that patients that need extra support get it. All of that happens with partners. And it's really, at the end of the day, governments that have the responsibility to their citizens to ensure they have access to care. So everything we do is sort of enmeshed in this network of partners. And I think that is the only way for us. And there are different ways in different sectors to approach this. We made the decision really early on that the time and the capital that is needed for an end-to-end thing was not justified, that we had to move faster and that there just wasn't going to be the sort of Uber-like backing for serving poor and marginalized communities globally. So we had to be really creative and we had to get really good at partnerships and what I would describe as sort of a non-zero sumness and finding those. And what I think we've learned is that partnerships are between people and not institutions. And so we have to be really good at what we do. We have to articulate our role and our strategy and roadmap and ideas. And then recognize that partners are full of people who have problems too. And sometimes we can help each other, you know, and we can align on the vision for what the world might look like if it succeeds. That includes community health workers and community leaders. It also includes the district health offices that are not used to being engaged in traditional aid programs. It includes the Minister of Health that has an enormous mandate and lacks resources. It includes the funder that's looking to, you know, really do meaningful and impact-driven work. These are people, and turns out we can work together if we align.
Tell us about your decision to launch MedicLabs. I understand it's a health tech accelerator, which focuses on the use of data science to help provide equitable healthcare globally. Why do this? What fueled this decision and what do you hope to achieve with it?
I am really excited about this as a concept, but also the specific opportunities that led us to launch it. As a concept, we felt like we needed a lab or a space for long-term thinking and sort of the most moral imagination and creativity we could muster in global health, that we wanted there to be no question in our space of whether the most talented people with the biggest ambitions, they should not have to choose between working in data-rich environments in the private sector in a wealthy country serving wealthy people and doing this sort of social justice work. That shouldn't be a choice that they're making because of lack of environment and lack of resources and lack of sort of the technical infrastructure. So we wanted to create a space like that. And we also wanted to have it fully coupled, but set aside from the daily operations and product work so that we could look 3 or 5 years out and experiment with things, and it didn't have to work, but it had to be tried earnestly and respectfully with communities. And then together with those communities, we'll decide what to pursue further and invest more in. One of those ideas was this idea that predictive models could be a core component of community health systems. And we had early experiments working with the Ministry of Health in Kenya and Living Goods and the Gates Foundation, early experiments in predicting which children were most likely to be sick and not get care in time, and also predicting which women would want to deliver in a healthcare facility, but when it came time for birth, would end up not delivering. So sort of predicting home births. And the idea there is not only that we would predict, but that the ability to predict would shift resources so that, again, we can move the needle on equity. So that's an example of something that we probably would not be able to pursue unless we had a space in a lab like this.
Tell us where you see broad opportunities for technology to play a key role in enabling healthcare equity and more resilient healthcare systems. You've obviously thought a great deal about this, and just give us a lens in where you think tech is helping us deal with inequities in ways that pre these sorts of advancements, we might not otherwise be able to tackle them.
I really appreciate this question. And I would start with the lens that I think the big shifts are where the opportunities are. And then technology comes in to support them and to support sort of equity considering those shifts. And so I'll give you two examples of what I mean by that. One example is urbanization. It has been extremely rapid, and we actually don't have really good data on how fast different countries have urbanized. And every improvement on the data set that I sees a higher percentage of urbanization. That may not be true right now with COVID-19 and some returns to communities, but urbanization as a macro trend that has real effects and strains and challenges for a healthcare system is totally unaddressed in health system design. So we need different designs that recognize that people get lost in an urban environment, quote unquote, lost by the system in an urban environment. And that's a really big problem in the same way that people being sort of lost to distance or ignored by distance in a rural environment is a problem. And we need a new type of system, and we need technology that supports that new type of system. A second example is movement of people. And with climate change and other contextual factors, I think we're going to see at least 100 million, if not hundreds of millions of people who are moving and are moving unexpectedly and who don't want to be moving, and often across borders. And we do not have healthcare systems that are set up for that macro shift. And I got to just give one example across both of them. It may be that our healthcare systems need to be less hierarchical and place-based and more about care that's organized through social networks. And as soon as you say social networks, I know brain cells are firing about social media and different platforms, but what I really mean is starting to organize care by who knows whom and where is their trust. How might we care for one another, and how might technology support that in an ethical way? I think there are big shifts. We have to address them really proactively, and tech should support it.
So healthcare is something that is often, but not exclusively, provided by the government, by the states. You have founded a nonprofit that seeks to enhance health equity through its work. The private sector plays an important role in healthcare delivery, but often when profits and health collide, equity suffers. So do you think there is a space and an opportunity to bring an impact or an impact investing lens to healthcare in a way that truly delivers equity to bottom of the pyramid communities, the most marginal, the most vulnerable?
It's a great question. And the short answer is that as long as we expect the same returns, I'm not going to be championing it. It's not going to be exciting to me. And what I mean by that is, if the story for impact investing is that, investing in companies doing good sort of how it's presented in their impact frameworks leads to the same return on investment financially for the investors, then I just don't think it's going to move the needle in terms of equity and healthcare. And, there's a lot of interest in investing in healthcare businesses. And I kind of wish there weren't until incentives changed. You know, if we're expecting venture returns on healthcare, you know, what does that mean about what that care is going to look like and who it's going to be for? You know, in the US at least, those VC firms are betting on continued waste and continued inefficiency and ineffectiveness of the public systems. So I don't want a world where we're betting against the public systems. And I think we would need investors that are excited about the equity improvements as much as they're excited about the financial returns. And until I see some shifts there, I'm not going to call it the answer.
So tell us what advice you would give to budding social entrepreneurs. You obviously you won an award for social entrepreneurship. You have built what is by any measure a globally recognized and very important institution, which is contributing in its own way to a broad systemic problem. Somebody wakes up in the morning and says, I'd like to be a social entrepreneur. I'd like to tackle some of these grand challenges. Based on what you've achieved and what you've learned so far, what advice would you give?
I think, first of all, my advice would be advice that echoes Brian Stevenson, a charge or a request to get proximate. And what I learned early on was that the people that you're accompanying and you're spending time with and you're building things with, for me, the community health workers and then others, they're your co-founders. You know, they're the people you're going to sort of embark on this venture with. And then they're the people you're going to return to for ideas and inspiration and just partnership in the long haul. So get as proximate as you can. And right now that's difficult because we aren't traveling, but you know, there are different ways. So getting proximate is sort of step one. And for me, at least, I had to journal a lot and then I had to listen to myself. And there was a point where I was, you know, if you had 10 seconds with me or a minute with me in a lunch line or something, you were going to hear about community health workers and technology. And, you know, if you're listening to yourself, you sort of know when you can't not do a thing, you can't not pursue it. And that became really clear to me at some point. And it wasn't, you know, waking up one day and realizing I want to be an entrepreneur, but it was that you know, forming an entity, recruiting co-founders, finding the resources, building product. Those were answers to sort of how to move an idea forward for and with the people that were my co-founders, for those community health workers. So yeah, I think pay attention when you have to do something is what I would say.
People who work in healthcare often are exposed to a fair amount of pain, of illness, even death, to a fair proportion of the tragedies that the world has to offer. But you also have to be an optimist at heart, I suspect. And so tell us what it is that gives you hope.
I truly believe that the way we get out of the mess that we're in right now, I would say, you know, COVID-19 just amplifies and brings to light the extent of the mess that we've been in for some time. But I believe that the path out of that is caring for one another. And I think that as I look at it, you know, we have decades of examples of people who are waking up every day to go out, knock on doors, care for their neighbors. And those are the people that I return to. You know, the question of what gives me hope, it is always those community health workers and knowing that that network of people is there. You know, I can walk into almost any community on the planet and ask, you know, who's the community health worker here, or who's the person who looks after you all? And they're going to point me to their door. It's usually a woman of color. But it's a network of people who are there and have been there for a long time. And the remaining question is, what are we going to do with them and for them? And by with them, I mean in partnership and accompanying them. So, yeah, I think you know, it's the network of people that give me hope.
I think that's an extraordinary note upon which to end. Thank you for all the extraordinary work you do to the millions of people whose lives you've impacted in several continents, and for the role model and the inspiration you play to social entrepreneurships everywhere. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Paul. It was an honor.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation, please visit chwy.jnj.com. Once more, chwy.jnj.com. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com.